May it please the court. Good morning, judges. I'm Doug Perko. I'm representing the appellant and plaintiff below, Michelle Medina, concerning her claims arising from the loss of a surgical sponge inside her during a joint surgery performed by the defendants below, Drs. Keeler and Drs. Garrico. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my argument for rebuttal, so if you could, Judge Tomlin, let me know a 15-minute mark.
Yes, I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you. The trial court committed reversible error in granting directed verdicts as to the two claims against Dr. Garrico. Here, by necessity, Ms. Medina was compelled to proceed under the theory and doctrine of res ipsa loquitur as to the direct negligence claims against both defendants. She was under a general anesthetic and unconscious at the time of the incident that injured her. And the true explanation of the events that injured her clearly were more accessible to the defendants. However, such explanation was not forthcoming. Dr. Keeler was one of two people in that OR that day that could have inserted and then failed to remove the sponge. As to the direct liability claim against Dr. Keeler, the trial court erred in determining there was no evidence of a duty for Dr. Keeler as an assistant surgeon to remove sponges, or that Dr. Keeler failed to do something he should have done. The trial court did not take into account or overlook clear evidence at trial that a surgeon, whether lead or assistant, who inserts foreign material not intended to remain within a patient is responsible for removal of that material from the patient's body.
Mr. Perko, can I ask you I was a little unclear on what exactly your direct negligence theory is. I get you're saying negligence because of the sponge was left in. Are you also saying negligence because Dr. Keeler recommended Dr. Garrico or no?
No, that was not.
All right, so it's just the sponge. All right, so then I guess my question for you is, what evidence was there that Dr. Keeler put the sponge in?
The evidence was that either one of the two surgeons could have put the sponge in, and under the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, the burden of proof then shifted to both defendants to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he or she respectively was not negligent.
Was it the nurse who said they either one of them could have put it in? What was the precise testimony?
The precise testimony was both doctors said that assistant surgeons do place sponges, that either one of them could have placed the sponge, and that they didn't remember a sponge going in or themselves remembering, which either doctor didn't remember putting a sponge in this incision number 3 where the infection arose.
Mr. Perko, the trial court judge said that the relevant issue was not who put the sponge in Ms. Medina, but who was responsible for not removing the sponge, and that there was no evidence that Dr. Keeler was responsible for not removing the sponge.
Well,
what is your response to that?
First off, trial court's ruling focused on the failure to remove as the misfeasance or act of breach here. But that focus, while it's correct in determining what is the act of breach, is misdirected and fails to address that when the question is the existence of the duty, and that's what the court's determination in directing verdict in favor of Dr. Keeler was, that there was no evidence of a duty. The existence of a duty, who could have placed the sponge, is indeed central to who has a duty to remove the sponge. And in fact, the evidence here showed that Dr. Keeler himself recognized the surgeon's obligation and task in this regard when he testified, "It is the goal of a surgeon to remove all sponges he or she has inserted inside a patient before skin closure." So there was further evidence that Dr. Keeler had a doctor-patient relationship with Ms. Medina that would impose upon him a duty to observe standards of care and not injure or harm her in his treatment of her. And further evidence at trial was that either one of these defendants could have placed the offending sponge and forgotten to remove that sponge. Ms. Medina was unconscious and unable to assist in the true events this information was more accessible to the defendants, and they weren't forthcoming in describing who put the sponge in. So she had to proceed against both defendants and under a theory of race.
So, Mr. Perko, if I'm understanding you, regardless, you're relying on this who could have put it in, and I think if I'm understanding, since Dr. Keeler could have put it in, Dr. Keeler would have had the duty to take it out if he put it in. Is that right? All right. Do you rely on res ipsa? Your theory of direct negligence relies on res ipsa regardless of those facts, correct?
Correct.
All right. So then under res ipsa, if I understand it, you had to show that Dr. Keeler was in exclusive control of that instrumentality. How do you establish that?
Well, first off, Your Honor, if you look at this Colorado Supreme Court's listing of the elements of res ipsa, exclusivity of control or any control is not a required element. In fact, in the Gamble case and the Raven versus Ambrose case, their three elements are essentially that this type of event doesn't ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence, that responsible causes, other than a defendant's negligence, is sufficiently terminated, and the type of duty that is involved here is within, or the duty that's at question here is within the scope of the defendant's duty to the plaintiff. The element of control is used frequently in sponge cases. However, it's not a necessary element. It goes to show, as one way, to show the second element of res ipsa, that you are sufficiently eliminating other causes. And the Supreme Court has recognized that in the Montgomery elevator case, and so did this court in the lower court's decision in the Montgomery elevator case, that exclusive control or any type of control is not a required element. However, here the trial court did find that there was sufficient control by both defendants, or the plaintiff's proof showed sufficient control involving both defendants here, that if either one of them, because of this court's decision in the Kiddo case, which was a medical negligence surgery case where res ipsa was applied against three different defendants, applied against the operating surgeon, the hospital, and the anesthesiologist, where the court determined that as long as the plaintiff shows that one of the defendants, or show that one of the defendants had control, or somebody for whom they have responded superior liability for had control, that is sufficient to establish control. Hence, you establish the second element that's required for res ipsa.
This was Dr. Derrick's site, was it not? She was responsible for the surgery that occurred at that site.
Well, to say that she was responsible for the surgery at that site is correct up to an extent, because when it came time to close incision number 3, Dr. Derrico and Dr. Keeler paused during the surgery and stopped and jointly discussed and decided how incision number 3 was going to be closed. They both chose and decided that a subcutaneous layer would not be subject to closure, and that is in fact where the offending sponge was left. So the decision on how closure was going to be done on incision number 3 was actually a joint decision.
But the closure was done by Dr. Derrico.
Dr. Derrico stitched the skin, and Dr. Keeler applied dermabond to that particular incision.
So she opened and closed that site.
Well, in conjunction with...
Well, I understand they had a conference, but she, in fact, did the closure.
Well, she did the skin closure suture, and Dr. Keeler applied the dermabond. And I think that...
Well, whose obligation would it be, if there's a difference, to explore that wound and make sure all foreign matter is removed?
The obligation would rest with the surgeon who inserted the object, the foreign object that was not intended to remain, and on anybody else who was closing that incision.
So if Dr. Derrickow introduced evidence that it was Dr. Keeler who placed the sponge, that would be evidence of Dr. Keeler's independent negligence, the fact that it, he inserted it and it, he did not remove it.
Yes, that could be part of the evidence.
But Dr. Derrickow would be responsible under the captain of the ship argument, regardless of who placed the sponge.
Well, not in this particular case, because Dr. Derrickow did not select Dr. Keeler. In fact, the opposite happened here. Dr. Keeler selected or recommended Dr. Derrickow. Ms. Medina met and had an initial patient relationship with Dr. Keeler, who suggested this joint procedure, and then recommended that a general surgeon be involved in the event that the abdominal wall masses would be removed during the process of her surgery. And Dr. Keeler then recommended to Ms. Medina, Dr. Derrick.
I'm afraid you lost me, Mr. Perko. On the Judge Roy asked you about the captain of the ship doctrine, and you were talking about who referred to whom. I guess I don't understand the relevance of that. As I understand, and I'll have two related questions on captain of the ship. I'll give you both of them. Captain of the ship talks about who took control of the OR at the time. So I guess I'm not clear why it matters who recommended whom. I don't think there was much dispute during phase four of this surgery. Dr. Derrickow was in charge of that, and it seems to me was captain, or argue, at least a pretty good argument, was captain of the ship. So I'd like you to address that. But as a preliminary question, are you raising on this appeal the captain of the ship argument with respect to Dr. Derrickow? I looked at this, and your opening brief doesn't seem to address it. That seems, I think that's your best argument with respect to Dr. Derrickow. You don't seem to raise it. And in fact, in your reply brief, you say that the defendants are wrong for talking about captain of the ship. So would you, could you clarify whether you're raising Dr. Derrickow's liability under captain of the ship? And then could you explain what you're just talking about how who referred to whom is relevant?
The question is, yes, we are raising Dr. Derrickow's liability under captain of the ship in this case.
Was that in your brief?
It was most certainly addressed in the brief under the JNOV section relative to that we thought JNOV should have been directed against Dr. Derrickow on both her direct liability and respondent superior liability under captain of the ship. Why I am bringing this up in terms of the position here, there was joint supervision and responsibility, and we don't know which surgeon placed the sponge. So we weren't in a position to argue the respondent superior liability of one of the physicians for the other physician.
But how does that relate to captain of the ship? Who placed and took out the sponge? The issue is who was in control of the OR.
And the liability there is for any claimed negligence of the OR staff. But here, we can't point to one physician, one surgeon, and say that particular doctor was the principal and the other surgeon was the agent at any particular time, because we don't know who placed the sponge in. And we can. The evidence showed, and it is argued relative to the directed verdict against Dr. Keeler on the respondent superior liability claim, that that was in error, because the evidence showed there were jury issues on Dr. Keeler's control and supervision throughout the full course of this 1 hour, 20-minute surgery. Both doctors assumed control and supervision.
Are you saying there were two captains of the ship?
Yes.
And are you also saying that I'm not relying on the captain of the ship doctrine with respect to Derrickow for Keeler? In other words, she's not liable for Keeler's conduct under the captain of the ship doctrine, only for the operating room staff.
Right, because we couldn't go to the point of saying who placed the sponge. At that point, we couldn't say that there was a captain of the ship relative between the two positions, which position was supposedly the principal and which one was supposedly the agent.
Mr. Perko, you have about 5 minutes left.
In connection with the joint, with the Rule 59 motion filed by Ms. Medina, we had requested that judgment notwithstanding the verdict entered against both defendants on direct negligence claims. This particular claim was denied by, or this request was denied by operation of law, but it was nonetheless reversible error. Here, because the defendant's evidence simply did not meet the burden of proof by preponderance of the evidence on the issue of breach of care of either defendant, that the defense did not meet their required going forward or their burden of proof in this case, and since res ipsa applies to both defendant doctors, it was error not to enter a verdict, enter a judgment notwithstanding the verdict on the issues of breach of care and causation in connection with the direct negligence claim for failure to remove the sponge. At this time, I would like to reserve the remaining time unless I can answer a quick question.
Very well, Mr. Perko. You have 3 minutes and 39 seconds left for your rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel, members of the audience. My name is Deanne McCall from Holland Evans.
Excuse me, before you get started, I just wanted to inquire how you and Mr. Mann intend to divide your time.
We'll see how it goes.
Okay, that's fine. Sure.
I think Mr. Mann, like, the last 5 minutes.
Okay.
Again, my name is Deanne McCone from Holland Evans. I represented Dr. Karen Darko in the underlying trial. Dr. Darko was a general surgeon who assisted in the surgery for Ms. Medina and performed the excision of endometriomas from Ms. Medina's cesarean scar. This case involving a retained sponge was tried to a fair and reasonable jury in 2009. And after hearing all of the evidence presented during that trial, that fair and reasonable jury awarded, found in favor of Dr. Darko. That jury found that she was not negligent and found that there was no causation. And based upon the evidence presented at trial, the court properly denied plaintiff's motion for our J&OB motion. Now, plaintiffs would have this court hold that the application of res ipsa loquitur means an automatic finding of liability against the defendant and a slam dunk for the plaintiff. But res ipsa loquitur does not require such a finding. Rather, it is merely a rule of evidence that relieves the plaintiff the burden of presenting experts regarding negligence at trial. In this case, plaintiff did not solely rely on res ipsa loquitur. She brought an expert to trial to testify regarding the standard of care, causation, and damages in this case.
So your argument on the direct negligence, Ms. McClung, is that your client, or you, overcame the presumption that res ipsa gets, correct?
Yes, and mind you, there are two claims that the plaintiff brought against Dr. Darko. One for the sponge, and the second half of her claim was that Dr. Darko was negligent in the follow-up care treatment. He didn't timely diagnose the retained sponge. So,
I do understand that, and because of the limited time, I guess I'll tell you what's troubling me and be just very direct. Okay. I have a lot of trouble on the captain of the ship doctrine with respect to your client. Yeah, and so, you know, tell me how your client was not the captain of the ship and why she shouldn't be liable for at least the negligence of the nurses?
Well, the captainship is a doctrine that part of, I'll leave my opinions regarding captainship at the door. But the captainship implies liability to that surgeon when they step into the operating room and assume control and direction of that operating room. This captainship liability does not apply to circumstances that occur before the surgeon has stepped into the operating room and assumed control of the surgery. And it does not apply to those circumstances in which it is post-operative, in the post-operative period, when the surgeon is, again, not in the operating room and not assuming control.
Do you deny that? I mean, somebody committed negligence when that sponge didn't come out when the doctor was operating. Don't you agree with that?
I think that there was ample evidence that was discussed during trial regarding the manner in which surgeries occur, the manner in which, how the surgeons direct their surgery, how sponges may be used, the reasons for the sponge count process, because the surgeon must always have the patient's best interest in mind and is watching that patient as the surgery goes through. They're focused on their surgery, they're concentrating on the performance of the surgery itself. During the surgery, there are sponges placed, but the sponges are sometimes left in the wounds for a period of time. When the surgery is completed, the surgeon always inspects the wound to be sure that there's no bleeding going on, there's no sponges, instruments, sharps, those sort of things. They always inspect it. However, in the case of the sponge, the problem is once they are soaked with blood, they end up being blood colored and the same color as the tissue within the body. Therefore, you can look, you can inspect, you can be as careful as possible and not always see that sponge. That is why for many, many, many years, through hospital operation, policies and procedures, and the American Association of Operating Room Nurses has developed this kind of sponge count process in which the nurses count the sponge before the surgery, they count right before the wound's closed, and then again after the wound is closed. And depending on the surgery, there may be variations. But the reason why they do that is because that's the second step of the process. The surgeon first looks, but they can not see that and not be negligent in not seeing it because the sponges sometimes can't be seen by the naked eye.
But this argument, so you're making a compelling argument on direct a response to direct negligence, it seems to me. I'm not sure, respectfully, that you answered my question and maybe I didn't answer it correctly. Can you say, wasn't somebody negligent when that sponge got left in at the time it was left in? I understand you're trying to say, and you argue in your briefs, that the negligence happened on the initial count before Dr. Derrico walked into the room. And I guess I'm challenging that assumption. And isn't it true that somebody was negligent? Maybe not Dr. Derrico because she was relying on what they told her, whatever else. But it seems, I guess, how can you say nobody was negligent when a sponge was left in this woman's body?
And I understand that you prefer the clarification.
Sure.
But let's talk about that. Again, captainship only applies to make that surgeon liable for any errors when she has control of the operating room staff. If the negligence occurs prior to her assuming that control, then she is not liable for that. In this particular case, the initial setup of the room, which includes the sponge counts, the sharp counts, the instrument counts, those all occur outside her supervision and control.
Counsel, I think you're avoiding the question, Judge Gabriel's question. His question is, your client closed the wound.
Yes.
And your client is responsible for inspecting the wound. Now, you're saying, as I understand your testimony, it's impossible to see this, but isn't it your client's responsibility closing the wound to inspect it to be sure that sponge is not there? And isn't the fact that the sponge is there virtually prima facie evidence of negligence?
And I would disagree with that. Again,
I assumed you would, but why?
Because a surgeon has a duty of reasonableness, and in performing their duty, they take their efforts. They make their best efforts to look, to inspect. Dr. Darfu did this. And there was testimony at the time of trial from expert surgeons that discussed this, that once a sponge is placed and becomes blood-soaked, even when you're doing your best to locate it, it sometimes can't be found even though you're looking right at it. So it's not necessarily negligence not to be able to see or find that sponge.
You can't see it. Pardon me. You can't see it and you can't feel it?
No. Dr. Darko places a finger inside the wound, and even afterwards, when Ms. Medina returned to her office with an infection in that wound, she inserted a finger and felt in there and could not feel that sponge. So it is not negligence not to be able to find it, but the reason why we have that second step, the sponge count process, is so that there is an extra counting, okay, do we have all the sponges? Because we know, and it's been proven over many, many, many years, that you cannot always find them, always see them.
But as I read your brief, you're saying that the sponge miscount excuses your client from liability for the sponge remaining in Ms. Medina. Is that your position?
I'm saying that the jury had ample evidence to find that Dr. Darko was not negligent and was not the captain of the ship with respect to the negligence of nurses.
And that's because, in your view, any negligence that happened before Dr. Darko walked in the room.
Yes.
Is that correct? All right. Is there... And I guess that's probably what I'm fighting you on a little bit here. Couldn't you argue here that whatever negligence happened before, let's say it was 11 sponges, not 10, they miscounted at the beginning, that negligence carried on throughout the entire thing? I mean, let's focus on the nurses. Is it your position that at the time when Dr. Darko was in the room and they did counts 2 and 3, there was no negligence by the nurses at that time?
There was no, and I agree, there was most likely no negligence by the nurses during the last two counts, because, again, when the sponges come in a little plastic tub with a paper cover. On the top of it, it says 10 sponges. They're supposed to open it onto the table, and then they're supposed to count each individual sponge. My argument is the most likely cause for the error is their failure to count those sponges and be sure that there's only 10 there rather than 11 or 12 or 13 or 9.
Ms. McClung, let me follow up on that. Is there an inconsistency between your statement that if there was negligence, it occurred before Dr. Darko came into the operating room on the one hand, and the trial court judge's statement that the negligence occurred when somebody failed to remove the sponge, which would have been while Dr. Darko was in the operating room?
No, because I think the trial court, clearly, when we were drafting jury instructions, and because of that issue was generally directed to Dr. Keeler, but the trial court clearly considered that it was very likely that the negligence occurred prior to Dr. Darko assuming her role as captain. That was clearly discussed on the last day of the trial and during the jury instruction conference. So
it wasn't negligence to forget you put a sponge in there?
No, again, because during surgery you're doing many things. And while, as Dr. Darko and Dr. Brock and Dr. Keeler all discussed, while your memory is part of what you rely on, your visualization is part of what you rely on, it is not the be-all, end-all. The way that we're sure at the end of the case that there are no sponges left in is by going through the sponge count process. So you do your best to remember, but during the surgery, you're busy doing the surgery.
And the failure to remember is not negligence?
No, Your Honor. There was testimony at trial that a failure to remember is not negligence.
I know that you want to kind of give Mr. Mann a chance.
Yes.
Counsel, but just one last question for me. Mr. Perkle argues forcefully in his brief that this is a non-delegable duty. He cites Ochoa for that. Ochoa cites Fields, now called Baumgarten, from California for that. It's not clear to me that Ochoa actually bought that doctrine or not, but I'm curious whether you think there is a non-delegable duty regarding sponges? Because it does seem to me your defense is the nurses did it, I didn't do anything. And that I have some concern whether that's inconsistent with the captain of the ship doctrine.
Well, again, and I think that argument does not take into effect the entirety of the evidence that was presented at trial. Because this really was an extensive trial where, again, surgeons on Dr. Darko's behalf, surgeons on the plaintiff's behalf, came and testified about the process. Okay, and again, I think it would have Grace Ipsa say, this is a slam dunk.
But what about the duty? And I'm interrupting you just because of time.
Right.
What about the duty? Is there a non-delegable duty? Can Dr. Darko delegate her duty to remove sponges to the nurses?
I think that a doctor must operate under the standard of care. I don't think that the standard of care in all instances says the failure to take out a sponge is ipso facto negligence.
So your position is there is no duty that she can, in fact, delegate her duty to somebody else.
I'm saying that she has to operate under the standard of care, and if she does that, she has complied with her duty.
I'm
getting there. But I also believe that, again, part of this process is the nurses doing their job and her ability to make sure at the end of that surgery that we take the extra steps to be sure that the sponges have all been removed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McClung. Mr. Mann, you have 6 minutes and 16 seconds.
Thank you, Ron. My name is Jack Mann of the firm of Kennedy, Childs, and Fogg. I'm here today on behalf of the defendant, appellee, Dr. Forrest Brent Keeler. In this case, the trial court properly directed a verdict for Dr. Keeler because the evidence was undisputed and was not sufficient as a matter of law to establish a prima facie case of either direct negligence or liability under the captainship doctrine on the part of Dr. Keeler. Now, on appeal, this plaintiff asked the court to accept two fundamentally counterintuitive propositions. First, that a ship can have more than one captain at the same time. That is, there can be more than one lead surgeon in control of the operating room at the same time. And second, that a surgeon is somehow responsible for retained foreign object, in this case, a surgical gauze sponge. In the absence of any evidence that the surgeon used any sponges for the procedures he performed, or that the surgeon placed the sponge in the incision where it was retained, or that the surgeon was responsible for closing or removing the sponges from the incision, or that the surgeon was directed to place or remove the sponge by the lead surgeon, or to count the sponge.
Well, Mr. Mann, what do you do about Mr. Perko's argument that a nurse testified, either one of them could have done it, I'm not sure. Both doctors seem to have testified, I don't know, could have. Isn't that enough to let a jury make that decision? Why not?
Because it's called speculation. Now, we have two theories of direct negligence that are being asserted here. The first is that Dr. Keeler himself was negligent, and the second is a res ipsa theory based on the fact. As far as the theory that Dr. Keeler himself was negligent, there was no evidence at all that he placed.
But what evidence, I guess I'm somewhat sensitive or sympathetic to Ms. Medina's argument. What else can she do if both doctors say, I can't remember? The best she can do is say, you know, they're not sure, let the jury decide. I mean, what else could she do?
Here was the evidence. The evidence was that the procedure was performed in four stages. First procedure, which was performed by Dr. Keeler, was a laparoscopic procedure, mainly to visualize the inside of her abdominal cavity. Now, there were no sponges used in that procedure because the incision used for laparoscopic procedure, about the size of a pencil, there's not enough bleeding to require a sponge. The second part of the procedure, control of the operating room shifted over to Dr. Darko, who then performed the second phase, which was the removal of endometrial masses that were blocking the way for the tubal ligation procedure that Dr. Keeler was to perform next. When Dr. Derrickow was finished with that procedure, which involved incision number two, the procedure shifted back to Dr. Keeler to finish the laparoscopic procedure in incision number one, which he closed and again used no sponges. There were no sponges in incision number two, so we're not even talking about that. Then Dr. Derrickow made incision number three. She removed more endometrial masses and closed incision number three. three. Now, the expert testimony, even from the plaintiff's expert, Dr. Ronahan, who admitted he didn't know who made what incision, was that the surgeon, the lead surgeon, is responsible for removing the sponges. And that was the stance with the standard of care is. And that came from the plaintiff's expert. In fact, if I can look at my notes here, his testimony was that each surgeon was in charge for that surgeon's procedure, and that the main or primary surgeon is the one who places sponges. An assistant surgeon can do so, but at the direction of the primary surgeon. It is the primary surgeon is responsible for placing and removing the sponges. So there wasn't even evidence that would establish that it was within Dr. Kamir's standard of care to remove the sponge in that procedure. That's why the trial court directed the verdict.
Mr. Mann, how does the res ipsa loquitur issue come into play, if at all, on the motion for directed verdict?
Well, it doesn't, because as Judge Pratt found, there was no evidence that Dr. Keeler was in exclusive control of the instrumentality here, which was the sponge. In fact, there was no evidence that anyone was in exclusive control of it. It was either the nurses or Dr. Keeler or Dr. Derichow. And to make a res ipsa case, you have to show, you have to be able to trace causation to the defendant. Now, Mr. Perko has made a big deal about how, well, exclusive control and instrumentality is not an element of res ipsa, even though in the most recent decision from this court, Ochoa versus Red, which also involved retained foreign object, that's what this court held. You have to show that the defendant had exclusive control of the instrumentality. There was no evidence here. Now, Mr. Perko is...
Sorry, Mr. Mayor, I didn't mean to get you, I know you're going, but what do you do about Raven? I mean, Raven is, you know, where the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court in Raven didn't mention anything about exclusive. Ochoa relied on Kiddo, which was many years before Raven.
The factor that Raven cites and Mr. Perko relies on is that responsible causes other than the defendant's negligence must be ruled out, right? That's just another way of saying the same thing, that the causation of the injury must be shown to be exclusive to the defendant in order to invoke the res ipsa doctrine. You can't say, well, he did it, somebody must have did it, when you have multiple defendants.
Isn't it the doctor's responsibility to parse that out and say who did what? And if they don't remember, how can they avoid joint liability?
The evidence here was that Dr. Derichow made a closed incision, number three, and that she was in control, had assumed control of the operating room during that procedure.
But she could have directed Dr. Keeler to put the sponge in or take it out, right?
Could have, except there wasn't any evidence of that trial.
And we got could have.
Right, could have. And could have doesn't get you to the jury.
And how does the plaintiff prove more than could have?
Well, that would have been the why you have the captain of the ship doctrine, is to say you're the lead surgeon, you're responsible. Anybody under you is negligent. Sorry, but you're responsible. I realize it's an archaic judicial fiction, but that...
I don't think it's an archaic judicial fiction at all.
Well,
I think it's a rule of evidence, and I think it shifts the burden to your client and the other physician to show what happened.
Except my client...
And if they can't, then they're stuck with what happened.
There was no evidence my client had assumed control of the operating room during anything having to do with incision number three, whether the opening...
So he had no duty to the patient?
Pardon?
He had no duty to the patient?
As the lead... Well, you're confusing things. You're talking about duty to the patient, which is a direct negligence theory, and the vicarious liability theory, okay? Because if the nurse breaches a duty, the captain of the ship is liable, even though the captain of the ship has not breached a duty. So if you're talking about a direct duty to the patient, no, he did not have a direct duty to the patient to remove sponges from an incision he did not open or close. And there was no standard of care, expert testimony, at trial that supported.
Mr. Mann, your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would request that the judgment for Dr. Keeler be affirmed.
Thank you.
I could address to the panel a couple of issues that arose on the defense's argument. Relative to the miscount that may only evidence in the record is that the miscount occurred in either counts number two or three of the sponges in the search or in the operating. In fact, the uncontested, undisputed evidence here was that with regard to count number one, the circulating nurse Brent Boynton recalled that count and counted 10 sponges, which was the amount that was contained in a box of 4x4 Raytech sponges, and he was certain of that particular. So there was no evidence to support, and it is only the argument of counsel that brings up this particular sort of issue of, well, there may have been, or could have been, a miscount on count one. In fact, in a sponge case, Mudd versus Dorr, where the res ipsa loquitur was found to apply as a matter of law by Ochoa, in that case, the defense counsel tried to argue the potential of some supposed or speculated argument, and the court said that is simply argument of counsel and won't be considered. With regard to the evidence presented by the defendants here, that evidence was wholly insufficient as a matter of law to overcome and address the defendant's burden of proof in this res ipsa case that they were respectively not negligent in the loss of this sponge. That evidence was solely directed to blaming, shifting blame, or delegating responsibility to the nurses. And I do believe that Ochoa adopted, as of the law of this state, a non-delegable duty on surgeons to remove sponges. The placement of a sponge and the removal of the sponge is the performance of surgery. It is the practice of medicine. Only Drs. Keeler and Dr. Derrico could perform surgery and practice medicine in that operating room. They cannot shift off to nurses that responsibility in the practice of medicine and the performance of surgery to see that sponges are removed from the patient. That is their responsibility. It cannot be shifted. It is non-delegable. This court and the Colorado Supreme Court have recognized non-delegable duties in various situations, particularly under the premises liability statute, where a landowner has non-delegable duties to invitees that come on that property. Surely, this state believes that a doctor's responsibility to their own surgical patient to remove sponges is at least worthy of that type of non-delegable responsibility as a landowner's responsibility is.
Mr. Perko, what is your response to Mr. Mann's contention that Dr. Keeler was not involved at all with regard to the placement or removal of sponges because of his responsibilities for the laparoscopic surgery?
He was the assistant surgeon on the open procedures. He told Ms. Medina he would assist in those procedures. He told the jury through testimony that he could have placed the sponge, assisting surgeon duty. He also told the court in quite some detail at trial that with regard to the closure of incision number three, it was a joint decision where they, or how he termed it, we had choices here. And we decided to not close that subcutaneous tissue level, and that's where the sponge was left. For the reasons and the authorities argued today, for all those presented in her briefing, Michelle Medina respectfully requests that this court reverse and set aside the direct verdicts and judgments entered below, and that this case be remanded with direction to the trial court to enter judgment notwithstanding the verdict against both defendants on the direct negligence claim as to the issues of breach of care and causation, and that a new trial on the nature and amount of damages be ordered, or at a minimum, remand this case for new trial on all issues against both defendants.
Thank you, Mr. Perko. Thank you again, Ms. McClung and Mr. Mann. That concludes the oral argument in this case. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will be issued in due course.